This is Susan Livingston reporting for Sequitur for Expressions of Peace Radio. Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. With habitat loss, ecological collapse, and consequent impending extinction as its main themes, Sequitur is a discussion of the natural consequences of actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zimpht. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur originated as the Global Extreme Weather segment on Extinction Radio. The weather and climate news felt too urgent to abandon when Extinction Radio went on hiatus last spring, so Sequitur became a freestanding podcast. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded beyond extreme weather events and natural disasters to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book The Myth of Human Supremacy to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. Aho, Mitakwe Owasan, we are all related. This is an important weekend in the USA. Gratitude Day was yesterday, Buy Nothing Day is today, and tomorrow is Small Business Saturday. I won't speak the more traditional names for these so-called holidays, or holy days, because in my cosmology, to name a thing is to invoke it or to give it power, and these days have traditional power that is anathema to all my relations. That being said, I feel stronger already. I'm borrowing content on Gratitude Day from Deepak Chopra. Surely you've heard about the benefits of the practice of gratitude, which we might define as the visceral and emotional response to having met a need. But maybe you experienced the death of a loved one this year, or a rude awakening about some social or ecological injustice, or some loss of capacity, or the end of an important relationship, and you're just not feeling it. Dr. Chopra offers 5 suggestions. 1. Receive gratefully. Before you mobilize your thankful response, slow down and dwell on the visceral sensation of meeting a need. Where is your gratitude located in your body? Is it an expansion of your chest? A tightening in your throat? A softening behind your eyes? And what need was it that was met by your receiving? 2. Take baby steps. Feel the miracle of the small things, the basic conveniences in your life like running water, toilet paper, refrigeration, and on-demand access to light, sound, information, and communication. 3. Look back. Where were you a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago? If you were in a better place then, you might experience gratitude for having had those experiences with those people in those places. If you're in a better place now, you might experience gratitude for your progress or achievements. 4. Reframe. Make lemonade out of lemons. Find the silver lining in the clouds. It's always there, for nothing exists except by its antithesis. 5. Don't let anyone tell you how to feel. It's not good to suppress your feelings or fake gratitude. If you're still just not feeling it, then throw yourself a pity party. But set a time limit to which you are willing to adhere, whether that's 10 minutes, an hour, a day, or a year. Remember that psychologically speaking, grief is the only feeling that persists for more than 20 minutes without cognitive reinforcement. Associated as its origin is with the very American holiday I've renamed Gratitude Day, I was surprised to learn that Buy Nothing Day is also observed in the UK, Sweden, France, Finland, Japan, Denmark, the Netherlands, and Hungary. I'm passing the mic to a colleague for a perspective from across the big pond.
Oh, thank you, Susan. My name's John Cossum, and I live in York in the UK. And Susan's asked me to do a little segment on Buy Nothing Day. Now, why would Susan have asked me to do that? Well, back in 2008, I was part of an organisation called a Carbon Rationing Action Group, and some of the members of the Carbon Rationing Action Group, knowing how low my carbon footprint was, said that I should enter a competition that was being run by Oxfam to find the person with the lowest carbon footprint in the UK. So I submitted my carbon footprint using a carbon calculator, and a few months later I found out that I had won it, that there were 100 people in the UK had submitted their data, and that I had been the person with the lowest carbon footprint. It worked out as about a 12th of the UK average. So how have I managed to do that? I've been very careful about many aspects of my lifestyle for many years. I only have a bicycle and use public transport to get around. I don't have a car and I don't fly. I do occasionally use a taxi. I am very careful about the energy that I use in the home, so I switch things off. But I also only use renewable electricity and a very small amount of fossil gas for some of the cooking. And we use wood stoves to heat the air in the house. They're clean burn wood stoves, so they're nice and efficient and clean. My diet, well, I've been vegetarian for 29 years, so I'm avoiding the high carbon that meat has. Now, one of the other things that counts towards a low carbon footprint is the amount of goods that we buy, the amount of things that we buy. And I don't buy very many things. I'm actually find quite a few things that I need. I'm a freegan, so I get food out of hedgerows and off trees, public trees, and I also go in skips and dumpsters and find stuff there. So it's a bit of an unusual lifestyle, but it does keep my carbon footprint low. So what is the UK collective carbon footprint? Well, I have the data from 2013. About 175 million tonnes of carbon were emitted by households directly. About 325 million tonnes were emitted in the making of goods and services produced in the UK and consumed in the UK. However, a whopping 582 million tonnes were from imported goods and services which were consumed in the UK. Now that adds up to over a billion tonnes of carbon dioxide emitted from British people and their lifestyles in 2013. It is important, though, to think of our individual carbon footprints. Now, in the UK, our individual carbon footprint, depending on how you measure it, is something between 8 and 10 tonnes per person per year. In the US, it's somewhere in the region of 20 tonnes per person per year. The world average is 4 tonnes, and in order for us to have a chance of staying under the 2 degrees C limit set as a target in Paris in 2015, we would have to get to a global average of 3 tonnes per person per year. So in the US and the UK, we have a way to go. Now, America and Canada are some of the highest per person emitters of carbon, along with places like Saudi Arabia, Australia, Qatar, Kuwait, Luxembourg, United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, all very, very high per person emitters. And China isn't on that list. China is the biggest global emitter for their country, but per person they're not. And that is because quite a bit of the stuff that they make is actually on our carbon footprints. We buy a lot of stuff from China, a lot of goods, and all that stuff has a massive carbon footprint of the coal-fired power stations that are currently polluting China. So it is obvious that a significant amount of carbon dioxide are from goods. Now, as far as I'm aware, goods and stuff and possessions and belongings don't really contribute towards our happiness very much. I know people who don't own very much who are happy. I know some people who own a lot, and they're happy too. I also know people who own a lot who are unhappy. So I don't think there's a good correlation between happiness and how happy we are and how much stuff we own. So we need to move on from how much stuff we own and how happy we think it makes us. Now, sometimes I'm able to share my expertise in carbon footprinting and green living with other people in workshops, and I run a needs and wants exercise. What I do is I ask participants in the workshop to write down a list of their needs on a piece of paper. I tell them that there's no wrong answer. They can write whatever they want, whatever they think their needs are, they can write it down, and nobody's going to look at that list, and nobody is going to mark them on it. People write down air and water and food and a house and a mobile phone and money and a job and their grandma and a holiday, and they write down all sorts of things that they need or that they think they need. Then I ask them to write down on the other side of the paper a list of everything they want, and there are no wrong answers. Nobody's going to look at the list. So they write down that they would want the new model of the mobile phone, a second holiday a year, maybe things a little bit less tangible like the neighbour's wife. All sorts of things go down on that list. I do sometimes see this list and it can be quite funny. Then I ask them to have a look at their list of needs again, the first list, to see whether they can transfer anything on their list of needs onto the list of wants. So it might be that they put the holiday from the list of needs into the list of wants. Maybe they put the latest model of the mobile phone into their wants and take it out of their needs. In the end, people are usually left with a list of needs that is quite short. It includes clean air and clean water and nutritious food and somewhere to lay your head at night, somewhere to live, meaningful things to do such as a job or a pastime or a hobby, and social connections. They're really important with social animals. But what we need to do is to fulfill our needs, and if you're not fulfilling your needs, then really there's something wrong. But we don't need to fulfill all our wants. We can certainly have some of our wants, but we don't need to have all of them, because some of them cost too much, some of them are unrealistic, some of them might even get you into trouble. So it's a way of explaining to people about how our lifestyles are very carbon heavy unnecessarily, that actually we can get by and be just as okay, just as happy, fulfilling our needs and only fulfilling some of our wants, but not all of them. So, thinking about doing things for other people, sometimes we show other people that we love them by buying them stuff. We don't really need to. We could make them something. We could write them a poem. We could write them a letter. I'm actually making dried fruit on my wood stove, and I shall reuse some glass jars and fill those with some homemade dried fruit. So next time you go to shop, maybe you should get what you need and not everything that you want. And really, that's the point of Buy Nothing Day. It's to make us think about what we buy and whether it makes us happy and how much it contributes to our global impact. So I hope that on Buy Nothing Day, you do buy nothing. Or if you do have to buy something, it is something that you absolutely have to buy. And I confess, I will be buying something on Buy Nothing Day because I'm intending to go and see a play in a place half an hour away. So I will be buying a bus ticket and going with a friend to see a play in a neighbouring city. So, you know, nobody's perfect. And all we need to do with Buy Nothing Day is to buy nothing that we don't need to buy. Thanks.
Thank you, John Compost Cossum, for that report, both universal and personal. I was especially touched by your description of giving dried fruit as a gift. My late father had a rule about gifts. He only wanted gifts that he could eat. It wasn't until after he died that I heard Charles Eisenstein's definition of a gift. He says that in order to retain its giftness, the token of generosity or appreciation must be consumed or passed along immediately. If you just put it away with others of its kind, it becomes something else, like an object, a possession, private property. And by the way, happy Charles Eisenstein's birthday, everyone! If you've never attended one of his presentations or read any of his work, I suggest you start with The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. If you feel ready for something more pedantic, try The Ascent of Humanity. The other thing that came alive in me as I listened to your report, John, is from my statistics teacher consciousness. You know, I've been tracking my carbon footprint since those online calculators were invented. And just like with any kind of survey data, the results and conclusions depend on what questions are asked and how the questions are framed. I thought surely when I quit driving and flying in 2012 that I would be able to reduce my demand to one planet's worth of resources instead of the average of 5 by my fellow Americans, or the 3.5 I was using to sustain my lifestyle, which was already as minimalist as I could make it. You can't imagine my disappointment on Earth Day 2013 when I measured my footprint and discovered that I was still consuming 3 planets' worth of resources, in spite of 0 flying, 0 driving, and living in a single room in high-density housing. I tweaked and fiddled with the calculator in search of answers and discovered that even with 0 discretionary consumption of resources such as water and electricity, totally local vegetarian food sources, and 0 participation in the cash economy, the very fact of where I live was incurring that privileged footprint, whether I used the streets that are built and maintained on my behalf or not, whether I buy the goods and services that are provided for me or not. So why bother? In the immortal words of Benjamin the Donkey,
"You know, doom can make it seem like nothing matters anymore. If you're asking which course to pursue, evolution says we're almost through. In the great cosmic game, things will end up the same, no matter whatever you do. Hee-haw!"
Your point is well taken, but I can't just do nothing. How can I find the energy to get out of bed in the morning if life has no meaning?
Hee-haw! Speaking of nothing mattering anymore, here's a little something on the subject. Ain't sweeping no dirt off no floor, don't seem like no reason what for. Climate heat's high degree plus failed nukes guarantee that nothing don't matter no more. Each day we see more to deplore, still in store much more horror of war. With nowhere to flee, there's no escapee, so nothing don't matter no more. At first it seems somewhat hardcore, using language that's hard to ignore. But si, senor, si, et monsieur, mais oui, nothing don't matter no more. Daily bread's always less than before. Dunno today's circus game score. Our NTE inevitability means nothing don't matter no more. Ain't sweeping no dirt off no floor. Don't seem like no reason what for. Climate heat's high degree plus failed nukes guarantee that nothing don't matter no more. Well, that's all for now. Hee-haw!
Actually, that's not all for now. You know, your friends the Donkettes set that limerick of doom to music, and I'm going to play it now as our cultural enhancement. Thank you for reciting it for us so we could catch all the words. Which reminds me, I want to tell our listeners that NTE is an acronym for near-term extinction. And now, I give you the Donkettes.
Ain't sweeping no dirt off the floor. like no reason what for. Climate heat's high degree, plus failed nukes guarantee that nothing don't matter no more. Nothing don't matter no more. Nothing don't matter no more. Still in store, much more horror of war. With nowhere to flee, there's no escapee. So, nothing don't matter no more. Nothing don't matter no more. First it seems somewhat hardcore, using language that's hard to ignore. But si senor, and monsieur, may we miss you. Denote today's circus game score. Our NTHE inevitably.
Donkettes Deb and Andy for that bittersweet interpretation of the words of Benjamin the Donkey. You are listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org, where we celebrate people and events that contribute to peace and nonviolence in action. You know, I can't fix climate change, or end war, or heal an earthquake fault, or prevent nuclear meltdowns, but I hope to provide an antidote to the gloom later in the show. So don't just stay home on Buy Nothing Day and feel sad or angry or disgusted about the consumer culture that is ruining our relationships with each other and destroying our habitat. The Adbusters ask that you make your non-participation visible by means of nonviolent direct action for your observance of Buy Nothing Day, or week, or year. Visit the Buy Nothing Day page at their website at adbusters.org/BND. Echoing the words of John Compost Cossum, they remind us that things don't make us happy, or if they do, it's very short-lived compared to the enjoyment we can find in our experiences of sharing and connection with each other and the natural world. In fact, they say, quote, "You might experience the most joyous holiday season you've ever had. Buy nothing and experience everything." Close quote. Try one of these three perfectly legal actions. 1. Credit card cut-up, appropriate for a solo appearance, a couple, or a very small group. Stand in a shopping mall with a pair of scissors and a sign offering a simple service to put an end to extortionate interest rates and mounting debt with one considerate cut. 2. Zombie walk. Fun for the whole family. Costume and makeup as dead people and wander around the mall or big box store, marveling at the blank, comatose expressions on the faces of the shoppers. As zombies, you are happy to be among your own kind, but are slightly contemptuous of those who have not followed the logic of capitalist consumption to its inevitable cannibalistic conclusion. 3. Worldmart. You and 9 to 12 of your closest friends go to a big box discount store and silently drive your shopping carts around in a long, inexplicable conga line without ever actually buying anything. If you really feel obligated or inspired to express your generosity by spending money on consumer goods to give as gifts in celebration of the winter holidays, why not wait until Saturday and support your local entrepreneurs and artisans? When you spend your money locally, more of it stays in your community than when you spend it at a national or global chain store. Perhaps you will spend more on each gift and purchase fewer gifts for your holiday dollars, but you will get more for your money in terms of intangibles like quality, integrity, and goodwill.
The destination of this train is Brain 3.
We interrupt this podcast to bring you an important announcement. Tonight marks a turning point in the evolution of Sequitur as we extend our runtime to accommodate Extinction Radio content. Last year at this time, Extinction Radio Series 2 was giving full coverage to the COP-Out 21 climate talks in Paris. As a fan and faithful listener, I remember being blown away by the 18 December episode in which Kevin Hester read his letter of resignation from the Green Party, and subsequent episodes in which various contributors and guests spoke of the COP-Out 21.
Hee-haw! COP 21. If you ever had any hope that we'd beat extinction and cope, then Paris in France shows there isn't a chance, so we now know the answer is nope. Exercise has utility for muscular capability. But COP 21 will get nothing done. It's an exercise in futility. Get angry in stage 2 and fume, or depressed in stage 4 with its gloom. Either reaction can serve as distraction from coming to terms with doom. A meaningless communique, but wine from a sommelier. Repartee and franglais, the local ballet, and cafes on the Champs-Élysées. There's no need for pique or dismay, whatever they do or don't say. We're not going to get through what's about to ensue, because it's now far too late anyway. It's over. Hello, termination. Many thanks for your participation. As reason departs, goodbye science and arts, and goodbye civilization. Hee-haw!
This year, Cop-Out 22 is in progress and has had nary a mention on Extinction Radio Series 3. So, in order to avoid compromising Sequitur's more general and ideological orientation, and at the same time make space for this very important content, we are launching Extinction Radio Series 4 with a special report from Marrakech, Morocco, hosted by Peter Melton. Whether Extinction Radio Series 4 will be a regular feature of Sequitur, an ad hoc special feature to fill in the coverage gaps in Extinction Radio Series 3, or take off as a freestanding show, will depend on listener reactions, as well as what direction Extinction Radio Series 3 takes. In any case, Extinction Radio Series 4 segments will be archived at extinctionradio.org, as well as included in the corresponding Sequitur blog post at panina.org. But before I move on to Extinction Radio content, I'll close out Sequitur with an update from Standing Rock. It's hard for me to imagine that anyone who has been at all conscious for the past 2 weeks could have failed to notice the escalation of violence that's been perpetrated using your tax dollars against unarmed sovereign people who are supposed to be under our protection. I was sick on Monday with the news of water cannons being used against the water protectors in spite of sub-freezing temperatures. This constitutes lethal force and terrorist action. And among other travesties, corporate media has sent no investigative reporters to the scene, but is instead reporting only what the authorities tell them in press releases. So the wage slaves who count on TV news are under the impression that it is the Sioux who pose the threat to public safety. A deployment of hundreds of combat veterans are on their way as I speak, and given the training they received at the hands of the military instead of the tribal elders, those reports may well become self-fulfilling prophecies. I encourage you to join the Facebook group Occupy Together Activist Support, where I'm posting boots-on-the-ground media, including live video. I encourage listeners to donate to the effort through the channels we discussed last week. For the links and contact information, go to panina.org and click on Domain in the right sidebar. The good news is that several municipal sheriffs from the neighboring states have refused deployment out of moral outrage at what they're being asked to do, to whom, and why. The flip side is that a greater proportion of the troops that are still on site are therefore North Dakota National Guard or pipeline mercenaries who are more likely to stay the course. To wrap up on Standing Rock, I want to invite everyone to join a global hour of synchronized silent prayer and meditation tomorrow, Saturday, 26 November, at 4 p.m. Eastern. That's 1 p.m. Pacific. This virtual event is organized by Unified.org, whose office is about a mile from where I hope to be living by next year at this time. In related news, my Blackfoot friend Running Wolf is extending the Stop Global Warming 4-day driving boycott to a monthly event. Why related? Because if we are going to stop resource wars, whether in the Middle East over reserves or in the Great Plains of North America over pipelines, if we are going to stop brutal extraction practices such as we see on indigenous lands worldwide, we have got to reduce the demand for the end products of those practices. Occupations and demonstrations contribute to making these practices financially unsustainable for the corporations, but it is market forces that sustain the economy, and we are that market force. That's the whole point of Buy Nothing Day, right? So burn no gasoline from the 11th to the 15th of each month, and punch a 10% hole in the corporate revenue from personal transportation. And now for our special feature, the launch of Extinction Radio Series 4. You heard Here to Hear singing Earthlings on Sequitur on May 20th. You can hear the whole song if you go to panina.org and click on Habitat in the right sidebar, then scroll to minute 19. For theme music for Extinction Radio Series 4, I've chosen a particularly significant excerpt from that song. I'll recite the lyrics here, and then I'll play them. If a human being doesn't question his actions, I don't know what a human being is. Oh, earthlings, earthlings, our perception's gone astray. We think we own the earth and we treat her like a slave. Oh, earthlings, earthlings, let's reevaluate our role in this experience and choose to change our ways. Oh, earthlings, earthlings, put aside your guns and bombs and armored trucks and realize that we are one. Oh, earthlings, earthlings, for we are here to love. Yes, la, 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 love in this trip around the sun. So let's hear Here to Hear. Welcome to Extinction Radio Series 4, where we'll be reporting on evolution in the Anthropocene. I'm your producer, Susan Livingston.
And if a human being doesn't question his actions, I don't know what a human being is. Oh, oh, earthlings, earthlings, our perception's gone astray. We think we own the earth and we treat her like a slave. Oh, oh, earthlings, earthlings, let's reevaluate our role in this experience and choose to change our ways. Oh, oh, earthlings, earthlings.
Oh, oh, oh,
oh, earthly,
you know that
earthly.
I'm a gonna sing it again.
Oh, oh, earthly, earthlings, our perception's gone astray. We think we own the earth and we treat her like a slave. Oh, oh, earthlings, earthlings, let's reevaluate our role in this experience and choose to change our ways. Oh, earthlings, earthlings, put aside your guns and bombs and armor trucks and realize that we are one. Oh, earthlings, earthlings, for we are here to love. Yes, la, 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 love in this trip around the sun. Oh, earthlings, earthlings. Oh, earthlings, earthlings.
Besides being embedded as the closing segment of Sequitur, archived at panina.org, Extinction Radio Series 4 is archived as a freestanding segment at extinctionradio.org. You can find the latest Extinction Radio podcast by clicking the link in the right sidebar or from the index under the Archives tab. There is more navigation support on the homepage at extinctionradio.org. Extinction Radio Series 4 was called forth by the absence of reporting on the Cop-Out 22 conference by corporate media, alternative media, and even by Extinction Radio Series 3, despite the avid coverage by Extinction Radio Series 2 about last year's conference in Paris. Thanks to Sequitur for offering the airtime to cover this year's conference. And thanks to Peter Melton for taking care of the aspect of podcast production most foreign to me, the interviews. So before we get down to business, Peter, I invite you to tell our listeners a bit more about where you are coming from with regard to evolution in the Anthropocene.
Good morning, afternoon, evening, whenever it is you might be listening to this. My name is Peter Melton, sharing the latest thoughts and feelings I'm having regarding life and the pursuit of what it is to be human during these very interesting times. Ah, boy, so much swirling around with the election and with the state of change in the Arctic and with the news that keeps popping up in more and more places about the melting of the Arctic or the incredible weather changes and just how real it's getting for those of us who dare to look at and feel into this topic of what it is to be alive in abrupt climate change Earth. And I had a great chat recently, a couple of great chats recently with folks daring to look at the word hope and daring to work our minds around how does this all sit with us? How does this all sit? We have to have blinders on to shelter ourselves from some percentage of the pain and anguish that's already going on around the world with the Earth itself, the natural resources of the planet, all the other species that are being affected by our desires and quest for happiness and consumption and overpopulation. And then the human journey as well, to look ourselves in the mirror and feel into, wow, this status quo, this way of being we've created in this Western privileged culture is unraveling. It's already unraveling. It may not have affected my daily life in a big way yet, but it's affected my daily heart and it's affected my daily mind as I dare to feel into the future, feel into how it is to be a young person these days. You know, I'm 54, and I think in general, those of us who've lived 50 or more years could kind of chalk it up as, well, I lived a pretty good life and got to enjoy a lot of things. But these blinders, how many blinders are we able to put on and still go about our daily world? And those who have fewer blinders are feeling more of the pain of the Earth and the other species, and those who are just in areas or dealing with the ramifications of all this change. It's hard to fathom what the body human, what this whole of humanity is experiencing, and how do we continue to be human, and how do we dare to know ourselves beyond our humanity? Did an interview that's on this show with a friend who went to the COP22, and she was feeling this global citizen feeling of, wow, there's so much more going on than what we see happening in the United States. And maybe to some degree, especially now with the election, we feel less powerful as the United States of America to guide the world toward the changes that are needed. And how does that feel? Coming from this indoctrination that USA is number one and we know best kind of energy that seems to permeate so much change and how do we deal with change? And it keeps circling back to how do I want to show up? How do I want humanity to move through me in these final chapters? And in this very interesting window of time right now where we can see it coming, but it's not here yet, to the privileged world that I live in and perhaps you live in. Wow, here we are. We want to enjoy the beauty. I want to enjoy the beauty that the earth has, the beauty of connection to animals and to the trees and the rivers and the oceans and all of it. I want to be with that beauty, but I have to be with that beauty under the asterisk, under the edge, the sharp edge of its unraveling all around me. And it brings an urgency. It's a different kind of urgency though. There's a calm urgency. There's an inspired urgency that makes me want to be present. And I think that's what it circles around to most is presence and being present to what is today, to the love that I am, to the love I can share, to the love that I can receive, to the beauty that I see, to the inspiration I can share, but also to the responsibility that I have to own that I was part of it, and that a certain energy of apology to the earth, to the other species, to fellow humans, especially to the younger folk, that, you know, the way we did this didn't work, isn't working. And we can do what we can to make changes. But I think, as Joanna Macy says in her definition of active hope, put the weight of your life behind what you believe in and what feels right to you without the attachment of the final outcome. Because I think we're in a place where the final outcome is likely to be not pretty at all to the human mindset, and that we must know ourselves beyond our humanity to express that infinite love we are into the world today, not knowing that it's going to make any difference at all, but to do it for the moment, to do it for the experience of the presence of now, for us as humans, to share the love, to be compassionate, to have the empathy, to take the steps that I'm drawn to take toward living a beautiful humanity now, and that the future will unfold as it does. And my role is to be me now and feel the feelings that I'm feeling and enjoy with the knowing that it's not adding up, you know, and to just be with that energy in the moment as best I can. Whew. Thankful, grateful for all that I can be thankful and grateful for daring to share, to talk about this topic, to create conversation around this topic, because we love the world and because I love life as it is and life as it will be. Gobble, gobble, gobble to all of you.
Thank you, Peter. That was an honest yet compassionate presentation of our predicament. You and Joanna Macy have a lot in common. I studied with her while I lived in Berkeley, and I know her administrative assistant and number one protege, Annie Simons-Boucher, from the NVC community. Maybe if and when I get back out there, we can set up a gathering to talk about evolution in the Anthropocene. Because, you know, I'm starting to question if fighting climate change isn't in itself a form of denial. Before I turn the mic over to you for your interview with Holly Stenson, I have a bit of background on this year's conference to share with our listeners. It's in Marrakech, Morocco, and it's hosted by Conference President Salahedin Mezawar. The official website is cop22.ma. Add a /EN to get the English translation, unless you can read French. The full three-part acronym for the conference is COP22/CMP12/CMA1. Say what? CMP12 is the 12th annual evaluation meeting of parties to the Kyoto Protocol, and CMA1 is the first annual evaluation meeting of parties to the Paris Agreement. I think I'll stick to COP22. There were important local and regional events taking place in parallel with the COP22, such as a Women's Leadership Summit and the first African Action Summit convened by His Majesty King Mohammed VI of Morocco himself. And there were meetings of various parties, such as the Subsidiary Body for Implementation, SBI 45, the Subsidiary Body for Scientific and Technological Advice, SBSTA 48, and the Ad Hoc Working Group on the Paris Agreement, APA 1 and 2. There were official side events associated with the conference with a threefold aim of enhancing ambition through promotion of pre-2020 action, promoting implementation by showcasing best practices, and providing support to developing countries. And finally, there were specially themed days such as Farmers' Day, Gender Day, and Climate Justice Day, and regionally or nationally themed pavilions and other exhibits by Indigenous people and on behalf of endangered habitats such as rainforests and wetlands. The main document that came out of the conference was a 9-point resolution Let me know if I've missed some important detail with my summary assessment that the only remarkable thing about this resolution is that it achieved ratification by all parties during the conference. Here are the 9 points. 1. We call for the highest political commitment to combat climate change as a matter of urgent priority. 2. We call for strong solidarity with those countries most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change and underscore the need to support efforts aimed to enhance their adaptive capacity, strengthen resilience, and reduce vulnerability. 3. We call for all parties to strengthen and support efforts to eradicate poverty, ensure food security, and to take stringent action to deal with climate change challenges in agriculture. 4. We call for urgently raising ambition and strengthening cooperation amongst ourselves to close the gap between current emissions trajectories and the pathway needed to meet the long-term temperature goals of the Paris Agreement. 5. We call for an increase in the volume, flow, and access to finance for climate projects, alongside improved capacity and technology, including from developed to developing countries. 6. We, the developed country parties, reaffirm our $100 billion U.S. dollar mobilization goal. 7. We unanimously call for further climate action and support well in advance of 2020, taking into account the specific needs and special circumstances of developing countries, the least developed countries, and those particularly vulnerable to the adverse impacts of climate change. 8. We who are parties to the Kyoto Protocol encourage the ratification of the Doha Amendment. 9. We collectively call on all non-state actors to join us for immediate and ambitious action and mobilization, building on their important achievements, noting the many initiatives and the Marrakech Partnership for Global Climate Action itself, launched in Marrakech. Other documents will follow, promises the UN website. COP23 will be hosted by Fiji in Bonn, Germany. COP24 will be in Poland. COP25 will take place at a to-be-determined location in Latin America or the Caribbean. Okay, over to you, Peter.
Hello, my friends out in Radio Land. This is Peter Melton checking in with the on-the-spot reporting from a dear friend of mine who got to go to COP22 in Morocco. Her name is Holly Stenson. Holly, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
You know, as this COP22 was happening, obviously so much less fanfare than COP21, that the 21 was the sexy, hey, we're all going to come together and do this. And as I understand it, the COP22 is a lot more of the nuts and bolts of, okay, how do we do what it is we said we wanted to do? And you got a chance to go there. So tell us the group that you're involved with and why it was that you went, and start off with that.
Sure. So I was able to go this year, and I agree with you. Being in Morocco was a lot of fun, although it was more of the nuts and bolts conference versus Paris last year, where, you know, they made the big announcement. But yeah, I was there. I was representing a client of mine called HippoWorks, and it's an animation house here in Los Angeles where I'm based. And the founder created a cartoon series actually about 10 years ago, quite a long time ago, that teaches children about climate change. And the lead character is Simon the Hippo, and there's a cast of characters. One's, you know, sort of this apathetic, they're all animals, and one's an apathetic little rat, you know, and he's always like, they're always having to drag him into doing good things for the planet. And he's like, why do I have to do this? You know, so they teach him why. And it's an adorable series. Well, this year, earlier this year, UNICEF called upon Dennis Thomopoulos, who is the lead animator and the founder of HippoWork, to partner because they were doing a big project where they wanted to teach children about the UN Sustainable Development Goals, the 17 goals. And so they were partnering with a bunch of different groups that were addressing each of the goals. And of course, climate change and things related to climate change actually are in about 13 of the 17 goals. So what they did, and they also partnered, is a partnership between HIPAAWorks, UNICEF, and then also a group out of London called Project Everyone, who is also working to partner with different content creators to address the sustainable development goals and just teaching different people, and by different people, I mean different age groups, about the goals. So it's a big awareness campaign, basically. And so ours was geared towards elementary age students, so kids anywhere from 4 to 12 years old. And he created these short 3 to 4 minute videos, each addressing one of the 13 UN Sustainable Development Goals that had to do with climate change. And so UNICEF, being a UN organization, was at COP, and they invited us to come to sort of be representative of this project that they're doing, because it was launched with HIPAAWorks. And of course, they'll be creating more partnerships in the years to come. And they also had us create a comic book that we distributed at the conference. And the comic book was a lot of fun. It was basically the comic book version of the 30-minute film that he had created that teaches kids about climate change. So, and you know, wow. So it was really great. We were also recently, well, we weren't, but UNICEF was distributing the content to the UN's General Assembly, UNGA, in New York, which was about a month before the conference. And there, they were giving this information to all the ministers of education from all over the world. So we felt really fortunate and lucky to have this sort of partnership so that this content can get out there and have the exposure that it, you know, should have. I mean, I think that we have to start young with teaching our children.
That's so powerful. So powerful. And oftentimes comes up. It's like, what do we say? What do we tell the kids? You know, it's like, wow, things are changing and the way we've been doing it doesn't work, but it's really hard to change, but we need to change. And it can be so hard, you know, outside of the easy stuff. It feels like there's an easy part about telling the kids, hey, it's important that we don't pollute, and it's important that we start looking at different energy sources. And, you know, there's that aspect of it. And then there's the deeper aspect of it that says, that has to, feels like to me anyway, accept that our status quo and the way that we have done living really doesn't add up.
Right. No, I absolutely agree with you. And it's, you know, it is important to start infiltrating these messages as young as we can. You know, there's a lot of songs in the videos, and any parents out there will know that songs are what make lessons stick in children's minds. You know, there's a friend of mine, I was showing her 4-year-old our cartoons, and, you know, she was singing along, and her mom was telling me that there's some other character that teaches them how to brush their teeth or wash their hands after they go to the potty. And, you know, and she's walking around the house singing these songs, and her mom was just like, this is great. I mean, obviously I have to teach her these things, but this is like just reinforcing it all. And so I don't even have to reiterate or harp on her about it. You know, she just automatically does it because she's singing it. So
what was it like to be there? I mean, tell me, like, you walking in the first time, you enter this big hall with how many people are there, and give us a feeling of what it was like.
Yeah, so the Moroccan government did a fantastic job of organizing it. I mean, it was really one of the most organized events I've ever been to. Even upon landing at the airport, they had shuttles available for anyone who was with the conference. I mean, immediately we got off the plane, we got, you know, it was very nice. If you were there for the conference, we were directed into a different line for passport control and all that. So we didn't even have to wait too long and in line. And then they had shuttles for us to different parts of the city. Wherever you were staying, they had a shuttle going there. And then they had shuttles every day all around town to the conference. So where I was staying, I chose to stay in an Airbnb, actually. You know, it was just a short 5-10 minute walk down to a stop where I knew the shuttle would be, and I could get on the shuttle and go. And they had the tents set up, like traditional sort of Moroccan tents. It was really fun. It felt like a very desert scenario, very Moroccan in the way it was decorated. They had restaurants on site that they had built. And actually, the way they built the structures themselves were really interesting. Like, the restaurants were made all out of sustainable plywood. You know, it was an amazing structure. I couldn't believe it. It wasn't an actual restaurant. You know, they built this whole thing just for the conference. And it was really done well. You can tell that they had sustainability in mind when they were setting all of this up. And of course, there were separate compost and recycling bins for everything. So there was a blue zone and a green zone, and you had to have certain credentials to get into each. But the green zone was open to the public. And so that was really cool. And so that was a lot of vendors. I mean, it was huge. It was just massive. I can't remember exactly how large. I'm sure you could find it online, but I think it was around 6 square kilometers. And on the green zone, they had a bunch of vendors set up, you know, different organizations, nonprofits, or for-profit businesses that were addressing climate change or were sustainable businesses, everything from, you know, nonprofits and foundations addressing climate change, both Moroccan and from other countries. A lot of Moroccan, obviously, organizations, because it was easy for them to get there and set up a booth, but also from all over the world, all the way to a sustainable resort organization that had a booth that was set up, you know, and they had like the chef from their sustainable kitchen there taste testing different sauces that he plans to serve in this new sustainable resort, you know. So it was really interesting. And then the blue zone where I spent a lot of time, it was the delegation, and you said that you had to have, it was a little bit stricter credentials you had to have, and that's where most of the meetings were taking place, and that was not open to the public. I have to say that the feeling that I had, I mean, it was just really exciting to be there, but I landed in Morocco before I knew the results of the U.S. election. So that was really interesting being there, because obviously the general feeling at the COP22 was a little bit of panic from the international community, since Donald Trump had said repeatedly while he was campaigning that he would pull out of the Paris Agreement. And then, you know, a week into the conference, he announced his new EPA director, who he plans to appoint, who is a climate denier. So people were very stressed out. I went to, at one point, a press conference with the U.S. Special Envoy for Climate Change present. And, you know, he was fielding questions from different international reporters from all different countries. And, you know, I hate to say it, but they were all asking the same thing, which is, what is this new administration going to do? Which, of course, he couldn't answer because, A, he wasn't appointed by Trump's administration, and B, his job is over January 20th. And C, he just didn't know. There wasn't enough information yet, since, you know, it had just been announced. But there was a definite heightened awareness that, you know, more work needed to be done, right, and that some work would be required to not lose everything that everyone had worked for that was at that conference for so long, it's for like years.
I think so many people felt was, oh my God, we feel like we've come so far. We know there's still a long way to go, but oh my God, did we just put it into reverse? And I think for so many folks here in California where I live and in the circles that I tend to hang out with, is like, you know, just this shock for a couple of days of, oh my God, what does this mean? And and then I did read one article, though, about COP22 that said after the shock wore off that there felt like there was maybe even the chance that there was some unity. Like, guys, we're really going to have to do this now. If we're going to, if the U.S. is going to be dragging its feet in any way, that we've got to come on so much bigger and stronger than we ever thought we did. And that to some degree there was like a, it was some sense of catalyst energy or some sense of, we get to unify because there's now one bad guy. I don't know, it was an interesting article, but it felt like, and maybe it was just a hopium article of people trying to find, you know, how can we make something good out of this? Because it sure doesn't seem good.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, that was going to be my next point, was that, you know, COP was long. It was 2 weeks. And the first week was panic and, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? And then I felt like the second week there was a lot more of, okay, let's put our heads down. We got to come together, you know, and it's exactly, I felt and experienced exactly what you read in that article, which was a deeper commitment to making this work, regardless of the United States' stance and the position they take. I mean, everyone, of course, is still hopeful, especially American organizations that have been working towards this for so long, that we will stay involved and you know, we won't pull out of the Paris Agreement and we'll still stay, you know, connected to those commitments that we made. But absolutely, I think the article you read was spot on. Definitely felt like people were more connected to it. And, you know, I personally was having a little bit of trouble with the results of the election, obviously. And I found solace being at the conference. And the reason why is it really brought me present to the fact that, you know, we're a country of only 300 plus million people. And this is a planet of 7 billion. And so, yes, things may be rolled back a little bit under this administration. And that is deeply disturbing and hugely unfortunate if it happens. But at least there's the rest of the world. And the rest of the world is really committed to this. And I feel confident in their skill sets and their people and their organizations. And so I found solace in that.
Do you think, or just as I'm trying to imagine a good scenario, Trump, I think the best possible scenario is Trump says, we are going to pull out and the entire world goes berserk and just has this amazing coming together of show of camaraderie around, no, we won't accept that answer.
Right. I mean, yeah, I think that is the best case scenario. And I hope that he doesn't pull out. But I think that if he does, I hope that that's what will happen. And I got the feeling being at COP22 that that will be what happens. You know, I mean, I was in Paris right afterwards. I went to Paris to see a friend right after Morocco. And there was a march in Paris. You know, I think people all over the world are still expressing their concerns over what he promised while he was campaigning. So we just have to keep hoping that he'll continue to roll back on some of those campaign promises like he's already demonstrated he's doing, particularly in the climate space.
Yeah. I'm interested in this feeling. I really heard you say, you know, maybe we as Americans have held America so big that we think, oh, nothing's going to get done without us, or maybe not quite that big, but almost. But to be there in your shoes and to feel, oh, my God, there's 170 countries or whatever the number was, and all these people and all these organizations and all these projects going on around the world. Speak a little more about how that felt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Morocco particularly, I was super impressed with, you know, their efforts towards eradicating climate change and trying to get us, you know, at that degree point where we want to stay so we don't all burn to a crisp. And you know, obviously they were sort of the heaviest presence there in terms of their organizations and stuff. But there were, you know, there was presence from all the countries. And yeah, I felt really confident. And it was sort of, I mean, look, I've traveled internationally a lot. And I think I have, you know, been fortunate enough to travel quite a bit. And I have that perspective that, like, okay, America's not the only, the be all end all. But this was truly even eye opening for people who traveled to see this sort of commitment from different organizations. I guess it's a little bit different when you're just traveling, you know, for pleasure versus seeing different countries' actual nonprofit and for-profit organizations come together and, you know, express their concern and also their commitment to what they're doing. And I was really super impressed with it. And, you know, it's funny when, I mean, also while we were there, it came out, you know, when China said, well, regardless of what Trump's plans are, we're committed to this. And everyone thought, oh, that's such a big deal, you know, especially since they're the second largest emitter of gases. And it is a big deal. It's definitely a big deal. But like, and I'll quote the, not verbatim, but I'll quote the U.S. Special Envoy for Climate Change, Jonathan Pershing, when he said, yeah, it's a big deal. And I'm really glad that they're continuing to be committed. But so are all of these other countries, too, you know, and that's important. And I think just recognizing that, you know, China's huge, America is huge, but we all have to be in this together for it to work.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I sit here thinking, well, I wouldn't have thought Morocco, you know, I wouldn't have sat here thinking, well, Morocco's doing a bunch of great stuff. You know, that you got that picture of, wow, this is really a global issue and that there are so many billion of us on the planet that, and people do care and people in a lot of places are being affected already in ways that the privileged North is not. And it's very real to some people around the world, whereas it's maybe kind of real to the privileged some.
Right. Well, we don't feel the effects of it as quickly, whereas other poorer countries do. You know, but even that said, I've done a lot of work in Kenya, as you know, for different things. And being there, I don't get the same sense of commitment to, you know, recycling and trying to take care of the planet as much. And the reason why, it's not that they're not concerned about it, because I'm sure they are, and surely they feel the effects even more closely than we do, living in the climate that they do, and given their diverse, you know, set of, you know, fauna and flora. But the difference is that there are other things, you know, there are other things. When your first priority is making sure that your country and its people have enough clean water and enough food, you know, that is sort of the first priority, and climate change comes sort of second. But, you know, I see the trend, and this is the truth, the trend is, well, climate change affects those things. So until we fix climate change first, these other things, you know, they'll fall into place. You know, hunger will be eradicated when we fix the climate change issue, when we start taking steps to protect our planet. Water will be, you know, a cleaner, more available resource. There's only a finite amount of water, but as soon as we start taking care of it the way that we should, you know, then that will also be, there'll be enough to go around. And, you know, Dennis, my partner at HippoWorks that I went to the conference with, you know, he and I talked a lot about it in the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And there's 17 goals, and we always like to argue that, you know, the 13th goal is climate change. And we like to say, well, you know, nothing really, all the rest of these goals can't be accomplished until number 13 is, you know, taken care of.
Yeah, exactly. So overall, and kind of looking to wrap up here, what kind of optimism did you feel? What kind of pessimism did you feel? Where did it end up landing for you as far as what you sensed as the group, overall group energy?
I felt a lot of optimism from the international community. And maybe not at first. I think they were, like I said, at first when the announcement was made of the U.S. election results, I think there was a little bit of, people were deflated, you know, because it is a huge influence. We are still, you know, the strongest nation in the world with the most money to address this problem. So there was a little bit of like, you know, what are we going to do now? But then by the end of it, people just were optimistic and were like, okay, we're going to get through this and it's okay. And yes, the U.S. is sort of a wild card right now, but, you know, we are who we are, and we can get through this, and we can all band together and do this. So I felt that overall it was a really optimistic environment. I felt, if anything, if there were any pessimistic things, it was probably from the U.S., and that was, you know, not only related to climate change and the work that we've all been doing and the disappointment and the new EPA director appointment, but, you know, just in the overall, wow, we're, you know, where's our country headed? But that had nothing to do with COP, you know? So.
Yeah, gotcha. Well, yeah. Thank you. Thank you for that bird's eye and bird's heart view of what it was like there. Can you plug one more time the program that you're working with there and tell folks how they can connect to what's up with that?
Yes, absolutely. So it's called HippoWorks, and they can go to hippoworks.com to check out the 30-minute movie. You can download it. It's just by donation, whatever you can afford. Please, you know, type it in. So it's HIPPOWORKS.com. And then also check out the worldslargestlessons.org. And that is what UNICEF and Project Everyone, that's their project, the world's largest lessons that HippoWorks is one small piece of. And that's, you know, teaching a variety of different kids all about the UN Sustainable Development Goals.
Great. Thank you. That's Holly Stenson from Southern California. Delighted to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun, and I'm really glad to have been with you today.
Thank you, Peter and Holly. I'm glad to see attention being paid to developing ways to talk with children in a compassionate way about climate change. And doing it through song is a great idea, although I still maintain that sustainable development is an oxymoron. I felt sad when Holly was talking about priorities in Kenya, where the people and their government are so preoccupied with basic survival that they don't have the luxury or the privilege of the big picture view. At the same time, I felt ashamed of our relentless selling of our newly enlightened perspective that if we do the right thing by our planet, then these other things like poverty and drought and disease will take care of themselves. I don't think it's necessary for the least developed countries or for those who are already being impacted to agree with the ideology when theirs is not the lifestyle that gave rise to the difficulty. And I was glad to hear that her assessment of the impact of the presidential election was not so divisive and grandiose delusional as portrayed by our corporate media. I'm still quite concerned by this neoliberal attitude that holds money as the panacea. The USA is not important because it has the highest per capita disposable income in the world, if you'll pardon the expression. The USA is important because it has the highest per capita consumption rate, the highest per capita emission rate, the highest per capita contribution to the waste stream of any country on the planet. Since even our alternative media thinks that reactions to the POTUS election is the only news worth reporting, I watched coverage of the climate conference on France 24 TV. I heard Rita Uwaka of Friends of the Earth's Nigeria branch say, quote, "There is no serious energy on the part of the negotiators. They are doing their best, but we think it's not good enough," close quote. Say what? So the best they can do is display no serious energy? Quote, "Participants also fear that the goal of avoiding the worst-case scenarios of global warming may not be possible without U.S. backing," unquote, says France 24 in response to threats by President-elect Trump to pull out of the Paris Agreement. Can we please synchronize our time reckoning? This is COP22. 20-plus years of failure, of high-profile, high-footprint negotiations cannot be retroactively blamed on the president-elect. France 24 also reports that Mr. Trump has agreed to meet with UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon soon, whatever that means, and cites a report by The Guardian from 15 November that the Secretary General is optimistic about the outcome of such a meeting and said, quote, "What was once unthinkable has become unstoppable," unquote. The Guardian reminds us on 12 November that, quote, "Just as President Obama's election did not mark the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal, as he claimed when he was first elected president, nor will Trump's election mark the opposite," unquote. The Guardian quotes a 2009 letter ahead of the Copenhagen Climate Summit addressed to the newly elected President Obama, which pointed out that clean energy technologies would, quote, "spur economic growth, create new energy jobs, and increase our energy security," unquote. The letter concluded, quote, "If we fail to act now, it is scientifically irrefutable that there will be catastrophic and irreversible consequences for humanity and our planet," unquote. President-elect Trump was a signatory to that letter. Say what? Is that what climate change denial sounds like?
You know, these new 3D printers are going to save us. If the oncoming famine caused slaughter makes you feel more and more distraughter, with the new 3D print, we're still in like Flint. We'll print out our own food and water. Hee-haw!
I also heard African Development Bank President Akinwumi Adesina say on France 24 that the overdeveloped countries, my description, not his, promised $100 billion to the developing world for investment in renewable energy and climate change adaptation, that is, drought and flood disaster emergency funds. And I'm thinking, I know, right? How can we think of directing development in our image while we continue the kind of exploitation and oppression we are seeing in North Dakota, South America, and the South Pacific, as well as the lower profile exploitation and oppression that we're not seeing elsewhere, due to the underlying mandate to sustain not our habitat, but rather our privileged lifestyles, with their addiction to on-demand global communication and mobility. I encourage listeners to visit www.cop22-morocco.com for full coverage and commentary on the conference, which might as well not have happened at all as far as corporate media in the USA is concerned. You are listening to the premiere of Extinction Radio Series 4, archived at extinctionradio.org, and also as the second half of Sequitur Gratitude at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action.
Hee-haw! It's Benjamin the Donkey again. You know, some deniers prefer the term skeptic, but taking a cue from similar politically correct words, perhaps we should call them pre-doomers. Pre-doomers and doomers, one finds, divide people of Earth in two kinds. Early explorers glimpsing the horrors, and the rest who'll soon change their minds. The world's full of pre-doomer folks, to whom climate warnings are jokes. They'll laugh less at the jest upon joining the rest who found out global warming's no hoax. The doomer's now seen as a loon, but we're all going to be doomers soon. Calling soon to be pre comes off more PC than to laugh and say, what a maroon. We're all caught in the very same net, we learn from this micro-vignette. BAU consumers and other pre-doomers just haven't become doomers yet. In the end, the world will attune to the song of the doomer commune. Those now in the choir can see things are dire. The rest will become doomers soon. Hee-haw!
I want to spend our time together here with a summary of the newly released 2017 report of the Climate Change Performance Index, a collaborative project by German Watch and the Climate Action Network Europe. Both of these organizations include the expression sustainable development in their mission statements. The CCPI is based on International Energy Agency data from 58 countries that are responsible for about 90% of global energy-related CO2 emissions. Those 58 countries were evaluated on their emissions levels and trends and their development of renewable energy sources, efficiency of energy use, and national climate policies. This is the first time in the dozen years the report has been published that emissions data from deforestation and forest degradation is included, thanks to the Global Forest Resource Assessment of 2015. Of course, the focus is still on CO2 to the exclusion of other drivers of climate change, such as methane emissions from industrialized agriculture and thawing permafrost. This year's report was authored by Jan Burke, Franziska Martin, and Christoph Ball. Despite decreasing growth rates in CO2 emissions, still no country performed well enough to reach the very good category. So the top three positions in the rank order are again deliberately left blank in this year's index to spotlight the failure of any country to achieve compliance with even the political 2C limit agreed upon in Paris. Note that languaging carefully. I didn't say decreasing rates of CO2 emissions. I said decreasing growth rates of CO2 emissions. In other words, despite the development to scale of renewable energy sources, CO2 emissions continue to rise. To me, that says that demand is still increasing. The elephant in the room, or the sacred cow, if I may mix my metaphors, is, of course, population growth. I'll give the top-level summary directly from the CCPI. Quote, for the first time in 5 years, Denmark is not leading the list but had to concede the top position to France, closely followed by Sweden and the United Kingdom. Though Denmark dropped down to rank 13, it still remains in the good performance group. Croatia and Portugal are the only countries to accomplish the leap from the moderate into the good performance group, Croatia climbing up 11 places to rank 17, and Portugal gaining 7 places up to rank 11. Compared to last year's result, Hungary has deteriorated most drastically by dropping 17 places from rank 17 to 34. Most of the very poor performing countries failed to improve their scores and remained there. Like the year before, Saudi Arabia, Japan, Kazakhstan, Korea, and Australia form the bottom five of this category. Now I'll break down the results by performance groups. There are 14 countries in the good group. The top three again are France, Sweden, and the UK, followed respectively by Cyprus, Morocco, Luxembourg, Malta, Portugal, Belgium, Denmark, Switzerland, Latvia, Italy, and Croatia. All of these scored above 60.5. Note that Morocco is the only non-European country in this top tier. Note also the conspicuous absence of the top emitters, China and the USA. By virtue of its diplomatic success in hosting of COP21, France advanced from 8th to 4th, despite fossil fuel subsidies of 13 billion euros per year, and their development of renewable energies falling short of what's needed to achieve their 2020 objective. The most precipitous drop was by Denmark. After holding 4th place for 5 consecutive years, the new government is not as keen on railroads and wind turbines and is diverting key infrastructure development funds to highway construction. The next tier of 16 countries are termed moderate and scored between 56 and 60.5. They are, respectively, Romania, Lithuania, India, Ireland, Indonesia, Egypt, Czech Republic, Greece, Slovak Republic, Netherlands, Mexico, Germany, Slovenia, Finland, South Africa, and Spain. India? Yes, while India is one of the 10 largest CO2-emitting countries, per capita emissions are still relatively low, with a quarter of energy needs met by renewable sources and arguably the best renewable energy development program in the world, resulting in an advance of 3 positions in the ranking. A precipitous 9-position drop was experienced by Ireland due to poor policy ranking, growing emission levels, and decrease in energy efficiency induced by post-crisis economic regeneration. Only their stellar record with development of renewable energy helped them to maintain their moderate rating. A more modest slide of 3 positions was experienced by Indonesia, despite their leading the field in the new deforestation-related measures. The next tier of 15 countries include the USA and China and are termed poor, with scores between 47 and 55.5. They are respectively Hungary, Poland, Argentina, Bulgaria, Norway, Iceland, Brazil, the USA, Malaysia, Ukraine, New Zealand, Algeria, and China. Surprised? I was. What are Norway, Iceland, and New Zealand doing here in the poor category? Argentina advanced 13 positions, mainly due to their progress in the renewable energy sector. However, national experts consider Argentina's future development as uncertain due to the latest change in government. The biggest drop in this poor category was 8 rank positions by the USA, second only to China in emissions, yet with a population only 1/4 the size of China's, due to deterioration in almost all of the index categories. Here is the only place I saw methane mentioned, an increase in emissions due to the shift from coal to shale energy sourcing. The very poor performing tier of 13 countries have scores between 25 and 47. Again, in order of rank from best to worst, they are Belarus, Estonia, Turkey, Chinese Taipei, the Russian Federation, Singapore, Canada, Iran, Australia, Korea, Kazakhstan, Japan, and fully 10 points below Japan, Saudi Arabia. This tier is remarkable for its lack of mobility in the rank order, although the analysts expect some mobility for Canada during the Trudeau administration. Turkey is still building coal-fired power plants, and Australia attempted to lobby the COP out 22 on behalf of so-called clean coal, while Japan's energy program is still committed to nuclear. Per capita CO2 emissions data clearly show differences between the CCPI countries that are correlated with the degree of economic privilege enjoyed by their citizens. They vary from 1.6 tons per capita in India and Morocco to 6.6 tons in China to 8.9 tons in Germany to 16.2 tons in the USA. Decarbonization of the global energy sector depends on both a shift from fossil fuels to renewable energy and an increase in energy efficiency. The following trends were noted. 1. In recent years, investments in renewable energies have surpassed investments in fossil fuels, and there is now more newly installed capacity in renewables than in all fossil fuels combined. 2. The precipitous drop in the price of oil did not lead to the feared surge in demand. This was attributed to the decrease in the cost of renewables and the lower interest rates that have stimulated investment in renewables infrastructure. 3. With China's announcement of its plans to abandon construction of 30 new coal-fired power plants, King Coal may be about to expire. 4. Several countries have announced plans to phase out fossil fuel subsidies and implement a carbon tax, with some already at the implementation stage. 5. The cost of energy-efficient technologies is going down. These include everything from light bulbs to home appliances to the building sector. Ratification of the Paris Agreement was achieved by the required number of countries on 4 October 2016, which means that all 197 parties to the agreement are now required to implement policies and processes to achieve their self-identified targets, for whatever that's worth. At United Nations headquarters on 22 April, 175 of the parties signed the agreement and 15 delivered their ratification documents. As of 9 November, the Paris Agreement had been officially ratified by the following 37 of the 58 CCPI countries: Algeria, Argentina, Australia, Austria, Belarus, Brazil, Canada, China, Denmark, Estonia, France, Germany, Greece, Hungary, Iceland, India, Indonesia, Ireland, Italy, Japan, Korea, Luxembourg, Malta, Mexico, Morocco, New Zealand, Norway, Poland, Portugal, Saudi Arabia, Singapore, Slovak Republic, South Africa, Sweden, Thailand, Ukraine, and USA. The following CCPI countries had not yet ratified the agreement, although some state that they intend to do so by the end of the year: Belgium, Bulgaria, Croatia, Cyprus, Czech Republic, Egypt, Finland, Iran, Kazakhstan, Latvia, Lithuania, Malaysia, Netherlands, Romania, Russia, Slovenia, Spain, Switzerland, Turkey, and the UK. On 21 September, the International Day of Peace, 31 additional parties delivered their ratification documents. According to the UN website, a total of 112 of the 197 parties have now officially ratified the Paris Agreement. I've already alluded to the blind eye being turned to emissions other than CO2, such as methane, and to sources other than energy production, such as industrial agriculture, never mind to drivers of habitat degradation other than emissions. The primacy of economic over environmental sustainability is nowhere so obvious or so succinctly stated as in the following two sentences from the CCPI. Quote, "Since the energy sector contributes most to the CO2 emissions of a country, renewable energy is the key driver for the transition to a sustainable world." Shifting energy production to renewables is also the most promising strategy for decoupling economic development from CO2 emissions. Close quote. Say what? Writing for the Australian Renew Economy, Climate Institute CEO John Connor describes the International Energy Agency's report to COP22 as more bullish than that agency has been in the past, especially regarding coal, with their claim that in order to have a 50-50 chance of meeting the goals of the Paris Agreement, CO2 emissions must be limited to 450 parts per million. In turn, that means a 2040 energy mix that is 58% renewables and only 24% fossil fuels. What's the other 18%? Why, nuclear, of course. And still there is no acknowledgement of the exponential increase in demand level due to increasing population and increasing influence in emerging economies that make the energy mix percentages totally irrelevant. I ask you, what could possibly go wrong? We'll leave it at that for this Extinction Radio Series 4 presentation, archived as a freestanding segment at extinctionradio.org, and also as the second half of Sequitur Gratitude at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. Thanks to my co-host and co-producer, Peter Melton, for his contribution and his interview with special guest Holly Stenson. To Benjamin the Donkey for his limericks of doom. To Bara Kay for her steadfast support of the ExtinctionRadio.org website. And to Here to Hear for the theme music for Extinction Radio Series 4. Thanks for listening to Sequitur, a podcast of expressions of peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart, archived at panina.org. Thanks to contributors John Compost Cossum for his reflections on Buy Nothing Day, Benjamin the Donkey for his limericks of doom, the Donkettes for their musical interpretation, and to Zimft for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston. Thank you.
illusion is so clear.